Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Just a heads up before we begin. This episode contains references to sexual violence, abuse, and intimate partner violence. Listen with care. On the last episode of Very Scary People, The Ken and Barbie Killers, 15-year-old Kristen French was abducted in the quiet town of St. Catharines. Eyewitnesses confirmed she was taken in broad daylight from a church parking lot walking home from school. After 2 weeks of investigating her disappearance, her body was found in a roadside ditch 35 miles away from home. The discovery of Kristen French sounded another alarm. Her case was strikingly similar to Leslie Mahaffey's, the missing girl who was found just a year earlier in Lake Gibson. As law enforcement made more connections between the two cases, it became more and more clear that a serial killer was operating in eastern Toronto. And after Carla Homolka was sent to the hospital, there's a break in the Scarborough rapist case. It's January 1993, 8 months since Kristen French was found dead. Carla Homolka is shaken up. The skin around her eyes is puffy and black, and her petite frame is covered in bruises. She's just come into the emergency room at St. Catharines General Hospital after being violently attacked during a dispute with her husband, Paul Bernardo.
The emergency ward and the doctor there said it was the worst case of wife abuse he'd ever seen.
The abuse is shocking because outwardly, Paul and Carla appear to be a beautiful young couple who have it all. The fairy tale wedding, the charming pink house, the loving relationship. Is it all a mirage? While Carla is being treated for her injuries at the hospital, the Ontario Provincial Police are called in for routine questioning. It's standard procedure when anybody is admitted into the hospital for injuries related to domestic violence. She doesn't hold back on the grisly details of what she's been enduring at the hands of her husband. Turns out, he isn't just physically abusive, he's controlling too. Here's Nick Prahn, a former reporter from the Toronto Star.
I can read all the things she wrote out to police. He forced me to drink alcohol daily. He made me stay up late even when I had to work the next day. He didn't allow me to seek medications. He strangled me with his hands.
It gets worse. Carla tells the officers that Paul is relentless and nothing can stop him. He can make a weapon out of anything.
He threw knives at me. He held a knife to my throat, hit me with a piece of firewood. He hit me with his shoes. He hit me with a flashlight. He hit me with a screwdriver.
But he didn't just hit her with it. According to Carla, he took the screwdriver and stabbed her with it.
He stabbed me in the back of the head, causing her scalp to bleed.
Carla tells the police every single graphic detail.
He often ripped handfuls of hair out from my head. He would punch me, he would kick me, he would slap me.
And she said the violent incidents escalated to emotional abuse too.
Once he pushed me down the stairs, He called me names, slut, whore, and the C word.
What they're hearing from Carla is undeniably gut-wrenching. It's heartbreaking, and it turned everything the community assumed about the young couple on its head. Day in and day out, she's being tormented and traumatized. Carla's life with Paul isn't the heaven-sent love she spent her girlhood wishing for. It is a living hell. Around the same time that Carla is hospitalized, experts at the Ontario Center for Forensic Science are testing DNA left behind by the Scarborough rapist, and the trail is leading straight to Paul.
They test it, and it comes up on the DNA, not as a perfect match as you would get today very easily, but given the technology at the time, sufficient to make him a person of interest.
So the police have some more questions for Carla about her husband.
So the police, as they usually do, is they do an investigation. Who is this guy and where is he living and what's going on in his life? They go to the wife to talk to her first. It's like a bullseye. You start at the edges and you move your way into the center.
Could Carla be the key to solving the Scarborough rapist investigation? A case they've been trying to crack for years? From ID, this is Very Scary People, the Ken and Barbie Killers. I'm your host, Donnie Wahlberg. You might remember me from our first season, The Amityville Murders. And now, in this season, we're traveling to Canada, a place known for its cold beer and warm welcomes, to trace the twisted path of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, a couple from Toronto that appeared loving and wholesome. The truth is, they were anything but. We'll explore how the boy and the girl next door became the killers known as Ken and Barbie. This is episode 4, The DNA Sample. On the surface, Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka had everything. A loving relationship, a sports car, a home to call their own, and an exciting future. Their life was full of the kinds of things that some people might envy. Kathy Kenzora remembers how important appearances were to them.
Well, it was very important to Paul and Carla to look like a really cool, young, successful couple. They were all about having, you know, the latest fashions and all the gadgets, and they were going out for fancy dinners and drinking champagne, and even their wedding was all about, you know, the pomp. I think it was very important to them to always look like they had everything.
In their Ken and Barbie world, everything was perfect. Megan Sachs, co-host of Women in Crime podcast, says it was all smoke and mirrors. The two were playing make-believe.
They were living dual lives, but yeah, in reality, they were not the people that anyone thought that they actually were.
They're smiling, they're happy, they look like young, energetic, normal people. They could be your neighbors.
Boy, were they wrong.
While Paul and Carla appeared outwardly picture-perfect to their community, friends, and family, Kathy says behind closed doors, it was an entirely different story.
Right from the early days of their relationship, whether it was controlling her to not go to college, restricting what friends she could hang around with, it, you know, eventually escalated to physical arguments and more aggressive abuse.
Paul had stripped Carla away from everything. He had been controlling and abusing her even before they were married. Mary Garofalo recalls watching a video from their wedding day where Paul openly referenced abusing Carla.
Well, a lot of videos were wedding videos where you go up to a guest and you say, congratulate the happy couple. And he would joke around about beating his wife. And meanwhile, he was actually beating his wife.
The signs were in plain sight.
I remember that video was sent to me. The uncle was joking around about, don't beat your wife. And she's looking in the camera because she knows very well that she's now being beaten every evening and being humiliated verbally by her husband every night.
Carla's body language and expression in the video revealed something both so sad and so sinister.
it was just so telling because she always had that fake smile on her face. It did not look genuine. It was, I'm keeping up the facade so that nobody can see how disgusting our lives are.
But Nick Prahn, who reported on the Scarborough rapist case for the Toronto Star, knew Paul and Carla's relationship didn't fool everyone. According to Nick, some wedding guests started to sense something wasn't right with Carla the day they were pronounced husband and wife.
You could tell that she had issues, but her friends at the time just didn't quite see it. They knew something was wrong, but they just couldn't put their finger on, you know, what exactly it was.
Some guests thought she had cold feet. Turns out, it wasn't just wedding day jitters. Carla was scared, seemingly trapped in a terrible situation, suffering in a never-ending cycle of abuse.
She was not happy at all. There was no smiling. And one of her friends said it was like I was going to a funeral and not a wedding.
Little did they know, what they were picking up on was that their friend was about to walk down the aisle and make a lifetime commitment to a man who actively abused her. But despite the ongoing violence in her private life, Carla went ahead with the wedding she so desperately desired. It's hard to imagine the abusive dynamic between Paul and Carla growing worse. But after the wedding, that's exactly what happened. The day Carla was admitted to the hospital, what she revealed to the police was brutal and nothing short of monstrous. Here she is telling the police about the abuse she endured in her own words.
I didn't turn the water tap off completely, he hit me. If I didn't say the right thing, he'd hit me. He held knives to my throat and told me I better watch my back. He said, always watch your back with me.
She wasn't safe anywhere Paul was. Not even when they'd sit down to eat together, drive around town, or at night when they went to bed. Every private moment between the two of them was an opportunity for Paul's violence towards her. Kathy says it wasn't long before Paul brought violence into their intimate life, too.
Also, she says, had started becoming more violent with her during sex and was using ligatures, and she was starting to get afraid that he might kill her.
Carla's feelings were right, because eventually he did threaten her.
He threatened that if she ever told on him or left him, she would not only kill her, but he would kill her family as well. And that's why she told the police afterwards. That's why she stayed with him.
The intimate partner violence didn't stop. And soon, Carla started missing her work shifts at Martindale Animal Clinic. She kept the abuse hidden as long as she could. But then her friends and colleagues started noticing signs of foul play on her body and face. Kathy says Carla showed up to work 4 days after the beating that ultimately led her to seek medical attention. When she showed up to work, they noticed she was badly bruised, with black eyes and scrapes too. I don't advise you look it up, but there's a picture of Carla on the internet taken in the aftermath of the attack. You can see the hospital gown tied behind her neck. Her blonde hair with dark roots is tousled. And under her closed eyes, you can clearly see just how deeply bruised they were.
And it was obvious that something bad had happened. She told her coworkers that she was in a car accident.
The car accident claim was suspicious. They didn't believe her lie, and the signs could no longer be ignored. Her coworkers felt they had no choice but to take action. They wanted to protect her from getting hurt again. It was time to get her some support.
Someone anonymously called her mom to say, like, something's going on with your daughter. You need to get down here.
Carla's mom, Dorothy, took the co-worker's cry for help seriously. Worried about her daughter, she quickly went to her aid. Carla's mom couldn't believe how badly hurt Carla was, and that the man she believed was such a caring husband, the man that she welcomed into her family and home, the man that she trusted her daughter with, could do this. Days before Carla's mom was called for help, Paul and Carla got into an argument that escalated quickly.
They'd had a fight over, he came home from doing something and she didn't ask him how he was.
And then Paul grabbed a flashlight.
He beat her very badly with a heavy flashlight. and really bruised her. She was clearly a victim who was battered.
The bruising from inside her brain caused like these raccoon bruises on her face that were just like massive black eyes.
At this point, her parents were kind of cued into what was going on.
And Kathy says once they knew the horrifying reality Carla was living, and after seeing her so terribly battered, they pleaded with her to leave Paul.
So the mom came to see her and was shocked when she saw her face and convinced her, you need to leave Paul. You need to get out of there.
They took Carla over to her and Paul's home to grab her personal essentials, the things they didn't share as a couple, her clothes, her toiletries, and her valuables, so that she wouldn't have to return.
She went into hiding, essentially, at her aunt and uncle's place.
Little is known about Carla's extended family. It seems fair to assume that they chose to protect details of their identities from the public in hopes of maintaining normal lives, a life without association to Paul Bernardo. Still, what we do know is that they were there for Carla in her dire time of need. She escaped the threat of his continued violence in Brampton, about 70 miles north of Carla and Paul's place in Port Dalhousie. That last physical altercation with Paul was the final straw.
Carla Homolka finally left Paul Bernardo.
Once Carla left their pink Port Dalhousie house, Paul started to face the consequences of his actions. Here's Kathy explaining how it all went down.
He was living by himself in the house.
Paul was spiraling. He couldn't stand the thought of losing Carla for good.
And, you know, by all accounts, he was just walking around aimlessly, like crying and making tapes, calling for Carla to come back to him and just really sounding like he was losing it.
So we went out looking for those tapes and we found them.
I've been here for 5 days alone. It's not a long time, but it's hard when you're alone. It's pretty hard, pal. I walk to the house sometimes. I go, Carla, hey, car. But I don't get any answer. It hurts so much. How much it hurts. It's like everything in my life, I did it to myself.
Amy says this was just the beginning.
And this is when everything started to fall apart for Paul.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Janice from Warner Brothers Discovery. I love my mom very much, and she's got some great stories to share. So do a lot of the other, quote, moms in my life. I was really excited to learn about StoryWorth just in time for Mother's Day. StoryWorth is an interactive way to preserve loved ones' stories for years to come. Here's how it works. Each week, StoryWorth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question. Questions like, what fascinated you as a child? Or, what do people get wrong about you? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. It can be long or short. It doesn't matter. StoryWorth then sends you a copy of your loved one's response, and after a year, they compile all the stories and even photographs into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book that will last for generations. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. Last year, when my mom turned 70, I asked her close friends to write letters, which I then gave to her in a keepsake box. She was so moved by this gift, so I know she's going to love StoryWorth. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll all cherish for years, StoryWorth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/veryscary. That's storyworth.com/veryscary to save $10 on your first purchase.
Back at the hospital, Carla finished up her formal statement with the police about the domestic dispute. It was clear from her interview and injuries that she was a victim of intimate partner violence. There was just no denying it. She agreed to press charges against Paul. Paul was arrested after the brutal flashlight beating, but he wasn't held in custody for long. But by the time he was released, Carla was in a safe place with support from her family. Paul may have dodged a longer punishment for physically assaulting Carla, but his luck would soon run out. His DNA had been tested on February 1st, 1993. And when the results came back, the police found a connection to the Scarborough rapist investigation. Remember, in November 1990, after police released the Scarborough rapist composite sketch, the Metro Toronto police brought Paul in for questioning. After being interrogated, Paul agreed to give a sample of both his hair and his blood.
Because of a backlog, his DNA had just been sitting, and they finally got around to testing it.
After digging into the official Metro Toronto Police Investigation Review, we found that there was a one-probe DNA match between the sample of Paul's blood and saliva and a semen sample taken from rape kits of the Scarborough rapist victims. It was enough to identify Paul as the probable suspect. But why did 3 years go by without further investigation into Paul? There were multiple tips pointing to him after the composite sketch was released. He was questioned and they had his DNA. Something wasn't adding up. It's wild to think that DNA would sit untested for years. But back then, DNA testing was still a pretty new science.
You know, we're not talking about today where we can move things quicker. You know, we're talking back in the 90s, there was one DNA technician and lots of DNA to be tested.
And Paul's DNA was among 79 additional suspect samples. There just weren't enough resources. And because the rapes had stopped in 1990, testing DNA samples was no longer a high priority. But given the state of technology of the time, didn't they know that it could be years down the road? They did have the DNA, but couldn't get the job done. Victims could have gotten justice sooner. It's baffling. Still, the timing of Paul's DNA match and Carla's experience with domestic violence at the hands of Paul couldn't be more of a coincidence. And for law enforcement, it was a long overdue discovery. That's when they knew it was time to speak to Carla again. Paul Hunter, who reported on the investigation, recalls how it all went down.
When they finally get around to testing, they say, hey, we've got a match. Where is this guy? Oh, he's in St. Catharines. Oh, and we've got a report that his wife had just been beaten up by him. Oh, so he's violent. They're starting to, wait a second, right? They go and talk to Carla.
And on February 9th, 1993, a month after Carla was admitted to the hospital, the police showed up at her aunt and uncle's home with more questions.
They sit her down and they say, "Hi, we understand you've been, you know, assaulted by your husband. We just want to ask you a few questions. Has he been violent for a long time? Is he abusive with you?"
Greg McCrary worked on the case as an FBI agent. He says Carla was cooperative.
She held it together during that interview with the cops, and the police did an excellent job in interviewing her. And they used, in my opinion, a very skillful interview approach with her. It was non-adversarial. It was non-accusatorial.
But then the interview took a turn. Greg says it was a turn Carla was not expecting.
I'm assuming she thought she was going to be interviewed just about the domestic assault. But then she found, there were Metro Toronto police officers asking her about, did she know anything about the Scarborough rapes?
Suddenly, Carla knew exactly what the officers were looking for. She started to panic. And during the interview, she dropped a bomb on them that they didn't see coming. The day Paul and Carla got married, Paul confessed something to her.
At the wedding was the first time that Paul informed Carla that he was in fact the Scarborough rapist.
Suddenly, the mysterious sense that something was rumbling under the surface of Paul and Carla's perfect relationship on their wedding day made sense. The guests who noticed a sadness in Carla weren't off base.
Carla says that was the worst night of her life.
And she carried the heavy burden of Paul's confession as a dark secret for nearly 2 years. With this revelatory information, law enforcement was able to fill in the blanks in the Scarborough investigation. Here's Greg.
It all became crystal clear as to what we were dealing with. The rapes had stopped when Bernardo had moved from Scarborough.
Things were adding up. Paul moved out of Scarborough and into the Homolka home in St. Catharines in 1990, which matched up with the timeline of when the Scarborough rapist seemed to have vanished. His last attack was May 26, 1990. Then, in February 1991, after Paul and Carla moved out of the Homolka's house and into their pink home in Port Dalhousie, there was an isolated daytime attack of a 14-year-old girl at a nearby bus stop.
Within 9 weeks of him moving in, there was a rape in close proximity to that, to his residence there at Bayview, that had all the hallmarks of the rapes that had occurred in Scarborough.
The sequence of events lined up precisely with Paul's moves.
It made perfect sense that this was what had occurred, and the escalation was there.
With Carla's case-breaking accusation and the timely DNA match, Metro Toronto Police finally had enough evidence to make their move. On February 17, 1993, an arrest was made in a case they had been trying to solve for nearly 6 years.
Police have 28-year-old Paul Bernardo in custody, accused of being the notorious Scarborough rapist. They arrested him late yesterday at this house in St. Catharines that he rented with his wife.
That evening, slumped over in white pants and an army green jacket, Paul was once again making his way into the police station, but this time in handcuffs. He kept the hood of his jacket over his face and his hands were restrained behind his back. He didn't look like a brazen criminal. He looked like a coward. A group of officers surrounded him. One had his hand at the back of Paul's neck as he guided him through the crowd of reporters. It was a scene. The press was everywhere. Everyone wanted to get a look at the guy who kept Scarborough on alert for so long and hurt so many women. Paul Hunter reported on the arraignment from a tiny room full of reporters.
"I saw Paul Bernardo for the first time after he was arrested. He looked like a guy. He looked like somebody who lived in Scarborough. Again, he didn't look like a monster. He looked caught and defeated, but he just looked like a guy. To see him finally, I thought, so that's the Scarborough rapist, right? I thought, that's what he looks like. And that was it. There was nothing special about the guy in the end."
His non-threatening, normal-looking facade could have been why he was able to evade police as long as he did.
We expect our monsters to look like monsters, and they don't always.
And in hindsight, his ability to hide in plain sight was one of the most terrifying things about him.
When you look at him in person, he's nothing. He's just a guy who did terrible, evil, dark stuff. And that unto itself was a lesson. It doesn't take a giant monster. It just takes a guy to do these things, and he did them. And I think that's what made it even scarier, because he could do these things.
On the next Very Scary People, the Ken and Barbie Killers, Toronto Metro Police have finally got their guy, and maybe even more. There's evidence to prove Paul is connected to the cases of Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French. The crimes are all on film, and what they'll find recorded will give them everything they need to arrest and charge Paul for kidnapping and murder. The police are sent on an urgent mission to stop at nothing to retrieve the tapes, the most promising evidence yet.
Everyone knew, of course, that you were listening to the last minutes in the lives of these young women.
Very Scary People, the Ken and Barbie Killers, is hosted by me, Donnie Wahlberg. It's a production of ID in collaboration with Neon Hum Media and is based on an original series created by CNN executive producer Nancy Duffy. At CNN, our senior producer is Sabina Ryman. Our producer is Allison O'Brien, and our associate producer is Michael Reyes. From ID, our executive producer is Jessica Lowther. From Neon Hum Media, our executive producer is Jonathan Hirsch. Koopa Mall is our producer, and our associate producer is Zoe Culkin. Our editor is Stephanie Serrano. Samantha Allison is our production manager. Our fact checker is Catherine Newham. Josh Hahn is our mix engineer. Theme and original music composed by Asha Ivanovich.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.